My name is Michael McCusker. Today is, of course, as if you didn't know it before, shortcuts, you sure do now, Independence Day 237. The Civil War took a decisive turn today in 1863 when the Union victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg were announced. Lee began his retreat from Gettysburg today, and the Confederate General Pemberton surrendered to Vicksburg on the Mississippi to Ulysses, sometimes known as Useless, Grant. And today is my season premiere on KMUN after a month's absence. And as I still are going with the dates, tomorrow is the 79th anniversary of Bloody Thursday, the 1934 Great West Coast Maritime Strike. I've been gone, as you probably have noticed, and last week, Ferlinghetti, commencement as a poet laureate of San Francisco, was on the air after a few mechanical problems. And I find it rather ironic because several years ago, some friends of mine took my newspaper, the Times Eagle, down to City Lights Books and gave it to him. And he, in turn, picked up a book he had just published of his poetry, signed his name to it, and dedicated it to the Times Eagle. And they brought it back to me, and is one of my prized possessions. Well, this morning I'd like to read something I've written. I call it Democracy's Day. And I should give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all the cosmos and reigning parallel universes. And I start with a quote by Bertolt Brecht. Would it not be simpler if the government dissolved the people and elected another? Politics, a strife of interest masquerading as a contest of principles. And that was Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary. Democracy begins at home, first in the heart. From there it radiates through the house into the neighborhood and community. It is found in smaller places rather than in centralized illusions of popular culture that reflect mind manipulation and mendacity, as well as gross distortions of constitutional processes and interpretations. Democracy is, after all, a compromise between the yearning for freedom and the urge to frustrate it. It is an elaborate, though inherently fragile, system of concessions between diverse and disparate ambitions and ideologies represented by a variety of economic and political classes, despite an enshrined myth that a democracy is a classless society. The only possible survival for democracy is to establish and sustain balance between conflicting factions so that none gain such power as to be capable of suppressing or ravaging the rest. In that sense, no debate or problem can be fully or finally resolved without its resolution becoming intrinsically repressive. If any one faction tips the balance of power for very long, the fabric of democracy is destroyed. Diversity is democracy, and vice versa. Unfortunately, the country is rapidly retrogressing from a diversely construed democracy centered on the rule of common folk to an aristocratocracy of immensely wealthy persons and corporations. The United States is at a crossroads as severe as the Civil War, a crisis that will determine its future as a nation and society. Either as a corporate oligarchy administered by questionably elected figureheads, or an open society as envisioned in its most fundamental beliefs and laws, as well as a leading member of a world confederacy of presumably eventual democracies. American history, boiled to the bone, might be encapsulated as war and money rather than about liberty and equality. If it is argued that the wars have all been fought for money, the pursuit of wealth reconfigures as the essential matrix of the USA's manifest destiny. This perspective of history is obviously an injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed bled, or died for the larger beliefs relevant in the Bill of Rights, the Ten Commandments of American democracy. Yet the very fact of the intensity of the strife for equity and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, wealth and who gets it is the mainspring of the nation's history. If indeed this narrow view of history has any credence, it must be realized that a select few have from the beginning profited from the collective effort of multitudes of ordinary citizens who generally prefer equity to imbalance. In this context, the term freedom is misapplied, both politically and economically. Free enterprise is a misnomer, for the fact that throughout the country's 237-year history, presuming the July 4, 1776 Declaration of Independence is construed as the nation's true beginning, the wealthiest Americans have for the most part accumulated and maintained their wealth at public expense, essentially through sales and subsidies, which can also be defined as the blood and taxes of the majority, who generally make possible but seldom share in the abundance. The real issue that is ripping apart the fabric of American democracy is the disparity of wealth, which complicates and corrupts every other issue. A few white men of wealth have made an intolerable grab for power and ordination of a country club apartheid that has severely eroded the basic fiber of democracy. They have looted the public treasury of billions while increasing poverty, joblessness, as well as legal and political savagery, and their short-sighted avarice has not only bankrupted the nation, it has burdened generations with a crippling debt that will further limit options and freedoms for millions of yet unborn citizens. Politicians who are supposed to represent the people are just political real estate for rent or lease. The plutocrats, whose affluence is to a major degree based on the upward flow of money provided by the poor and middle class they incessantly impoverish, divert the nation's wealth to their own private and corporate profit. They are the source of the dissolution of the society that indulges their insatiable and arrogant avarice. Capitalism and democracy are not synonymous. During the half-century Cold War with Communist Russia, capitalism was espoused as indistinguishable from democracy. But since the collapse of communism, the ancient antipathy between power at the top and the struggle for freedom at the bottom has accelerated in the United States. The top capitalists do not believe in democracy. They believe in predatory capitalism and in their own sovereign right for power over the rest of the people. Coupled with conspicuous avarice and class discrimination, this is a recipe for the disenfranchisement of ordinary Americans whose lives clearly deteriorate as a result of reactionary economic policies. Jobs lost and or sent overseas, labor unions eliminated, workers' rights and wages reduced, hours of work increased without compensation, health plans diminished or abolished, and retirement benefits dissolved. Yet even now, amidst the disastrous recession, depression that has left millions of Americans out of work and homeless, people still seem indoctrinated by right-wing platitudes that socialist-style government is the problem. The current political climate in the United States is one of incendiary revision, reflected by political parties and politicians condescending to right-wing ideologues and capitalist zealots who manipulate the democratic process to ultimately eradicate it by excluding everything and anything that is different or opposes a grim and vengeful vision of apocalyptic governance that excludes diversity, intelligence, and imagination, and which blames the nation's problems on such interesting and rather progressive persons as feminists, gays and lesbians, blacks, Hispanics, and recently arrived world immigrants who hope for the future rather than cling to noxious images of the past. It is the wealthy, whose affluence is to a large degree established on public money paid by the less affluent they incessantly impoverished, who are the real revolutionaries of contemporary America, because they are the source of the dissolution of the essentially liberal society that indulges their insatiable and arrogant avarices. From the very beginning of our democracy, a powerful minority has insisted that liberty is the property of the wealthy elite and the rest of the population is to be made to serve its interests. They subscribe to a constrained interpretation of the Constitution. Its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and propertied, its dues and obligations to everyone else. They would like to suspend the Bill of Rights and believe that what they call the original intent of the framers of the Constitution, who were all white propertied and or mercantile males, should be its only interpretation. The rigid concept of original intent is essentially religious in its implication that all progress of intellect, thought, and purpose ended with the instance of the Constitution's origin. It is an absurd and dangerous notion, contrary to the actual intent of the Constitution's authors, to make it flexible enough to reflect future problems and ideas they knew they were unable to anticipate, or too contemporarily divided in opinion to immediately resolve, among them the large movements to emancipate slaves and women. Our ancestors who wrote and ratified the Constitution knew very well that governments swallow the rights of their citizens, and citizenries, I should have said, and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate its power by any means. Reflexively, government subverts the rights of all but its ruling classes, even if the system originated to provide rights to the governed. The laws of the Constitution, and especially the added-on Bill of Rights, simply make it more difficult for the leaders of government to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. The assumption of freedom is that the average human being is intelligent and inspired by compassion, and that most people will think and act reasonably most of the time. The usual assumption of government is that the common citizenry is lazy, unintelligent, primitive, and brutal, and must be shielded from its own perfidious nature. The tendency of government is to rule, and it is a parasite. Government must, by implication or force of its sovereignty, feed upon and subtract the political liberties, rights, and powers of those it rules. It is the responsibility of a democratic people to contain the power of their government, which, without that restraint, will relentlessly take power away from the people. In the past century, the U.S. government has usurped much power to itself, some of it for the betterment of the people, such as civil rights laws, but also much of it against the people, epitomized by the half-century rule of terror, secrecy, and doubt that characterized the Cold War and nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. The political freedom and power of the common citizenry has been made the law of this nation to protect democracy from predatory or cruel government. Yet a government of the people is assumed to also be a government for the people, so it is entrusted to act in the people's behalf. Contrast to the current era of virulent capitalism abetted by the government. And it's going to act in the behalf, I just dropped the line, to prevent or correct the excesses of monopolistic and unprincipled private interests, which is in contrast to the current era of virulent capitalism abetted by the government. Neoconservatives are wrong when they claim that a free government must be free from government. The dismantling of government protections, which has vastly accelerated since the advent of the so-called conservative revolution 3 decades ago, alters government's role from acting as benefactor and protector of civil rights and liberties to its more ominous nature of guardian and enforcer of the reigning status quo, which is rancorously articulated by the wealthy elite and religious right. Freedom implies a mature citizenry, while the nature of authority requires that no one grow up. To be free and remain that way is a large responsibility, and many people don't want it. Political freedom insists upon the value of the individual, but the accelerated complexity of American society is constructed on aggregates and consensus and makes the contributions and usefulness of each of us less valuable. Our thinking and sense of self-worth are crucially affected. An individual and ultimately collective sense of personal and political helplessness sets in. The real purpose of the American experience is that human beings are capable of coexisting as equals, that so-called free competition is not one of unfair or dominating advantage. A democracy decays when enormous enormous numbers of citizens are unemployed, with poverty and homelessness their only prospects. The remedies for repairing and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe that has resulted from the past decades of government laissez-faire of business and corporate megapoly of the country are many and varied and depend upon reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. The practice of democracy has been less than its publicity, not completely a sham, but all too often a facade of liberty and equality. It has been treated as a vent for the little people to whimper and perhaps exercise a slim possibility to redress inequities between privilege and repression. Redress is extremely difficult to accomplish with no little bloodshed. The real power has always been with economic elites who rule as lords in a state dominated by wealth, and elected politicians are corrupted by the aristo-plutocrats who, like old Romans, exploit for their own benefit the new world order that rises on the ruins of Soviet communism. The persistent conundrum is that the actuality of democracy is far less than advertised, that neither freedom nor equity is the daily reality for millions of Americans who are governed instead as if they live in a police state because they are poor or are a minority race, that the old devils of worth measured by wealth, gender, and race continually and perversely undercut the foundations the nation claims to stand upon and believe in. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being part of a community not enslaved by it. The eternal, pitiless struggle between haves and have-nots, the despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economic and politically powerful few who are in their turn are angrily terrified by this rage. History is retrogressed by millennia of injustice, with periodic excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow the lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie and that it gave birth to an egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily resisted and only adopted with great reluctance. Reforms that have been ratified are usually countered with vicious backlash and unrelenting reversion. We are a democracy because it is necessary. It is not because of beneficent human nature that we have inherited a few basic rights and liberties sought by the mass of humanity for millennia. These limits on power are to curb the avaricious ambitions of many among us, to prevent them from getting their hands on our political rights. Our freedoms are, in essence, our obligations as well, to preserve them for our descendants as well as for ourselves. We are a democracy, yet we know little about democracy. Sovereignty, independence, and equal rights do not come easily and never stay very long without constant feeding and nurturing. It took a long time for people to be convinced of the possibility of freedom, even though our predecessors inherited a powerful but thwarted tradition of rights and liberties. Our own revolution was, in fact, the result of bitter disappointment the mother country did not recognize the loyalty to ancient principles its colonies in North America felt they had exhibited in resisting what they considered illegal and proscriptive edicts intolerable to honest and loyal subjects. Political rights or liberties, hard won by one generation, are usually eroded by successors who are careless with them, not realizing how rare, necessary, and fragile they are. The further removed we are from the intense imperatives of our ancestors for freedom and equality, the more we take for granted what they fought to establish, and the greater the danger we will allow them to be taken away. Loud voices proclaim that the United States of America is the freest, most wonderful country on earth, and unfurl the flags of worldly preeminence and godly jingoism. Quieter voices disagree, which is not to say the ideals of liberty and justice for all are not articulate in the nation, or that their intent is less than political and personal freedom, and something akin to equality under the law, however discriminatory its actual practice, for everybody now and in the future who live in its geospace. The USA probably should, as so many suggest, refresh itself in this dark period of crises and uncertainty with a fresh infusion of original principles, but these are difficult to pin down and incredibly problematic to apply to an evolving millennial society. The Bill of Rights and subsequent amendments clarify that original intent of the Constitution was not as restricted as the so-called strict Reconstructionist claim, but instead it is an amendable document able to reflect and serve a continually changing civilization despite hardships, frustrations, and bloodshed that accompany the amending process. The irony is that it is usually a minority of Americans who strive to protect the liberties and equalities of the majority, just as it is usually other minorities who crave raw power and will do anything to attain it and keep it. We have emerged from nearly a decade of the most radical and reactionary presidency in the nation's history. It perpetrated political and constitutional paralysis and arrogantly trampled over human rights in blatant contempt for democracy while attempting to accrue absolute power for itself. It made itself seemingly omnipotent to such a degree that any dissent to its policies, actions, or decrees was treated as treachery or at the very least unpatriotic. Such was the noxious decline of the national dialogue. 9/11 precipitated a crisis of democracy that might well be more momentous and more prolonged than the war on terrorism. The narrative of the Bush-Cheney era following 9/11 was that the country would only have peace and security through war. Civil liberties were dramatically threatened, and average citizens had little to say about it. Ordinary people were rendered politically and economically impotent and continued to be affected every day by consequences they seemed powerless to control. The country is at war, initiated by lies and illegal assumptions of power. Vital social services have been eradicated, as well as public health resources, because tax money is diverted toward war, and of course to the corporations and mercenaries of the military-industrial mafia that unabashedly profit from making war possible and continuous. The USA Patriot Act that was cobbled together with hardly a whimper of protest by Congress in the wake of 9/11 circumvents and represses constitutional rights and liberties, and the virtual abrogation of habeas corpus defies the nation's fundamental assumptions of the laws that govern it. The flagrant use of torture since 9/11 has eroded the assertion that ours is a nation of humane justice. Add to that volatile mix the current worldwide economic crisis created by avaricious American financial institutions that parasitically demand trillions of dollars of public funds to buttress their voracity while millions of American workers are thrown out of work and home. The Bush-Cheney reign was instructive in that it showed us the weakness and defects of democracy, confronting us with paradoxes of freedom and power that might never be fully resolved. The most persistent political question is the accommodation of liberty to justice, which has vexed American civilization since its beginning. And with revelation of massive telephone and internet surveillance, as well as continuing inhibition of dissent, persists to afflict the presidency of Barack Obama, despite his proclaimed intent to restore constitutional government. The essential issue is whether we are going to uphold what our ancestors started, or if we are going to undo nearly 2.5 centuries of hard-won and often bloody struggles for liberty and justice, and give it all away to a powerful clique of ambitious imperialists who manipulate our history as well as our passions and fears. The paradox is that our Bill of Rights are not for us alone, nor is the manifest destiny our political leaders attempt to export in a rather twisted and malevolent, entirely self-serving vision. Bewildered, exhausted, and despaired by the cold realities and complexities of modern government and its unholy alliance with corporate avarice and military force, perhaps we should adhere to parsimony instead of surrender, patiently trace the confused, corrupt tentacles to their origins, and from that basic point realize how we got off the track of the history we intended to navigate when our ancestors declared they could no longer abide the oppression of a king. The oligarchic, corporate, and financial aristocracy has spent the past 40 years eroding the average American's faith in constitutional government so that none will look to it to bring us out of peasantry. Unmentioned in the Constitution, but wholeheartedly advocated by so-called strict constructionists, they venture to convince us that democratic government is the enemy of the people. Yet the original intent of our founding ancestors seems to have been to accommodate the extremes of wealth and poverty, with the premise of political equality and social mobility available to all Americans. So whose democracy is it? Bernard Sanders, U.S. Senator from Vermont and Congress's only socialist, has an answer. Quote, if democracy is going to survive in this country, tens of millions of poor and working class people are going to have to see the connection between their economic conditions and the political process, he writes. They must vote not for the lesser of two evils, but for jobs, income, health care, and the dignity to which they as human beings are entitled. Only when that occurs will American democracy become revitalized. That was Bernie Sanders. In other words, the only way to save democracy is with more democracy, and by keeping a balance between conflicting factions, to allow none of them to attain such power as to be capable of suppressing or persecuting the rest. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle to right the balance of power in this country, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote in the New York Times, "One reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." What is freedom? The right to not be recognized by gender, race, or class, but by the simple fact of a person's existence on the planet. The right to be counted on and respected for personal and independent expression of belief and opinion. The right to be the only person on the planet who believes in something no one else does. Judge Learned Hand should have the last word. He said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women, and when it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it." And that was something I wrote, Democracy's Day. And I'd like to finish up with a poem by Langston Hughes, who lived from 1902 to 1967. Let America be America again. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great strong land of love, where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker, sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean. Hungry yet today, despite the dream. Beaten yet today, oh, pioneers. I am the man who never got ahead. The poorest worker, bartered through the years. Yet I am the one who dreamt our basic dream in that old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned, that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home, for I'm the one who left dark islands, Ireland's shore, and Poland's plain, and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today? The millions who shot down when we strike? The millions who have nothing for our pay? for all the dreams we've dreamed, for and all the songs we've sung, and all the hopes we've held, and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay, except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, that land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. For those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. America. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we, the people, must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain. All the stretch of these great green states and make America again. And that was Langston Hughes. Let America be America again. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.